You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 15th, 2006. This is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. With me tonight are Perry DeAngelis.
Hello, everybody.
Bob Novella.
Here.
And Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein is unavailable at the moment, but might be joining us later in the show. This is episode number 30, guys. Do you realize that?
Woohoo!
Wow.
3-0, the 3-0. Big 3-0.
That's
a
amazing.
A milestone.
Wow. Don't they say it's all downhill for me?
After 30?
That 40, I don't know.
Seems like last week it was 29.
So it's just zipping by, like the millennium.
Some item in the news to get us started. So our friend James Randi is in the hospital recovering from bypass surgery. Randi was a guest on our show a couple months ago, and his name seems to crop up frequently on our show. He is a celebrity skeptic. He did have some cardiac issues a number of years ago. I believe he had a mild heart attack and then recovered well from that. I don't have any details on what led to the bypass surgery this time around, but it did seem sudden, an unexpected thing. But apparently, by all reports, he is recovering well, but will be taking a break from his usual activities, probably for a couple of months while he recuperates.
I heard he used acupuncture as a procedure.
Yeah.
Oh, no, that wasn't him.
During the surgery, that was somebody else.
Steve, I like your description of him as celebrity skeptic. I've just been thinking about that. I can only think of three on the entire planet.
Who would you name? Who would the other two be?
Oh, Penn and Teller.
Penn and Teller.
Oh, what about the guy from the magazine?
I think Joe Nickel is a celebrity skeptic.
Yeah, definitely Joe Nickel.
I think Michael Shermer is a celebrity skeptic.
Well, Shermer and Nickel are B-level celebrities, though.
Oh, come on.
They're not at the level of Randi and Penn and Teller.
I wouldn't call them B-level, Steve. I think
they do not have the recognition that Penn and Teller have.
No, of course not. Of course. Who does?
Well, if they're B-level, what are you?
Down D-E.
Which makes you J, Jay.
Yeah.
I've been on television.
That's why we're on a podcast and not on 50,000 watts out of New York City. That's why, Jay.
So anyway, we all the guys at the Skeptic's Guide send a big get well out to James Randi. Hope he does well.
Yeah, get well soon, Randi, because we need you.
Another item in the news. This is our intelligent design watch. There have been a lot of political and legal developments on this front over the last year, and they're continuing. Yesterday, the Ohio Board of Education voted to remove language from its science curriculum that was specifically critical of evolution. So this is, again, is part of the evolution, if you will, of the intelligent design attempt to have that version of creationism taught in public schools. As you know, last fall, the Dover, Pennsylvania School Board was overruled in a court. I think that was the Pennsylvania state, or it was the regional federal court. Essentially, they attempted to insert into the public school science standards teaching of intelligent design. The Ohio Board of Education took it one step more subtly. They did not require the teaching of intelligent design. They just required the insertion of specific language that was critical of evolution, essentially encouraging students to think critically about evolution and to teach the weaknesses of evolutionary theory. Now, so it did, without specifically mentioning intelligent design or requiring the teaching of a specific theory. Yesterday, the school board, apparently under pressure from the Ohio governor, voted to remove that language. So that was, again, another victory for evolution and defeat for intelligent design and creationism. Although they still have to decide what their evolution science standards are going to be, so they haven't replaced yet. They just sort of removed what was there. A spokesman for the Discovery Institute, that's the The Discovery Institute is basically the home of intelligent design, described the board's action as a sad day for students of Ohio.
Oh. Steve, if anyone is interested on a lot of ID news, latest news about intelligent design, I recommend www.ntskeptics.org/news/news.htm. They've got lots of lengthy articles on just the latest stuff coming out with intelligent design. So I recommend that if you're interested.
Yep, that's a good site. The American Association for the Advancement of Science has a running sort of a commentary on ID. The National Science Teachers Association, www.nsta.org, has basically a timeline of ID news. We'll have these links, of course, on our notes page. Of course, you know, the thing that was interesting about this particular approach is that, again, they're trying the softest sell that they can, just saying, you know, we encourage students to think critically about evolution. Now, again, it's hard to say, well, that's wrong. Obviously, we advocate critical thinking of all scientific theories. But what is wrong about that is, first of all, it's unnecessary. It implies that mainstream scientists are not being critical of evolution like they are of all scientific theories. They're, you know, probing it for weaknesses and, you know, the strengths and weaknesses in the evidence and logic, etc. It is getting all of the critical thinking that all scientific theories get. So it kind of misrepresents science to suggest that, you know, we need a law to tell scientists to behave scientifically.
Well, what about them applying that to their own religion then?
Well, you know, the other thing is, it kind of brings up the other point, is that there's no justification for singling out evolution for critical analysis. What about all the other hundreds of, you know, theories that are taught in science classrooms throughout the curriculum? So it's the singling out of evolution and the suggestion that mainstream scientists are not being appropriately critical or skeptical that is unfair, essentially. And I think what really nailed them in this case was that a lot of the language in the school board's standards were very reminiscent of language that could be found in intelligent design literature. So clearly they were using that as a resource.
What a fall for them, you know? You know, they're trying to get it so that evolution is not taught, and then they're trying to get equal time for intelligent design, and now they're just trying to throw in a few words criticizing evolution, and
right,
still they fail. I mean, how much more of a soft sell can they make it?
Yeah, where else,
I mean,
can they go,
where
from
else
here?
They hit bottom, I think.
Yeah, I'm not sure. That's a good question. Where would they possibly go from here? I mean, I think they'll just have to, you know, reformulate themselves somehow. I mean, they're definitely not going to go away. We'll see how clever they're going to get. But the bottom line is, you know, they can't hide. You know, they can run, but they can't hide. I mean, any attempt at evolution denial, whatever guise they try to put it in, is pseudoscience. And
right.
And we'll see it coming. You know, it's not like they're going to slip one past the goalpost.
Steve, how long has intelligent design been on the radar?
Intelligent design, mid-90s. Yeah,
mid-90s.
Behe's
book. Behe's book. Behe started it with his
creationist.
I mean, what was the book, Steve?
Darwin's Black Box. Yeah.
I think I know what their new tactic is. They're gonna start a campaign to, you know, go try to find every evolution book out there and just write on it. Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
That'd be good. Be just as effective as what they're doing now.
But I bet you, Bob, that will get struck down too.
Yeah.
They essentially tried to do that. I mean, their oh yeah strategy was to have a insert put in the front of biology textbooks saying, you know, evolution's just a theory and it hasn't been proven and blah, blah, blah. And that was stricken down. So that was basically the equivalent of them saying, oh yeah, you know.
To be honest, I'm very shocked that things are going so well for evolution right now. I mean, a year ago, things were looking pretty grim.
Now, they never were looking grim. I mean, I think the intelligent design folks, you know, and the creationists, you know, have had intermittent success at the grassroots level, because you can always pack a school board when no one's looking with a few creationists.
And there's no way
know.
To immediately stop a school board. It takes time.
It takes time, but it always gets worked out. And the thing is, whenever the fight goes before a judge in a court of law where there are rules of logic and evidence, the creationists don't have a leg to stand on, and they always lose.
And Jay, you want Grimm? Just look around. How many states in this country are looking at legislation for this stuff? It's not, you know, it's not over by a long shot.
No. But I think we will consistently, you know, see victories in the legal system.
Amen.
Speaking of legal cases, this is kind of a quirky item. In Italy, an atheist sued a local priest for claiming, essentially for fraud.
Yeah, this guy's 72 years old, right? He's a retired agronomist, Luigi Cassioli, and he claims that a parish priest in his small town in Italy violated two laws. One of them is a law barring abuse of popular belief or fraudulently deceiving people. The other one barring, quote, impersonation, unquote, or personal gain from attributing a false name to someone. He of course, he was talking about the life of Jesus, this priest, back in 2002, a guy named Reverend Righi. He put out a news bulletin, a parish bulletin, that said Jesus existed, that he was born of a couple named Mary and Joseph in Bethlehem, and that he lived in Nazareth. Mm-hmm. He felt that the guy violated the laws by doing that, so he brought the case, made a complaint, and the case ran all the way up until just this month when it was dismissed. I mean, don't forget, this is in Italy, which is an extremely Roman Catholic country, overwhelmingly. But he, you know, he saw it through to this point. The judge, Gaetano Muotone, I believe it's pronounced, he dismissed the case. I guess he found that it didn't really have any standing. He also said that the prosecutor should investigate this Cassioli for possible slander.
For slander.
So,
right.
So he dismissed it pretty aggressively. The guy says he's going to appeal it. He's going to take it up to the European Court of Human Rights and try and keep going with it. Yeah.
Right. I don't think he's not going to get anywhere with it, in my opinion. Nor, you know, really, nor should he. I mean, I think trying to use the courts in order to go after essentially faith is, you know, certainly wouldn't work in this country. I'm not an expert on Italian laws, you know, the relevant Italian laws. But,
well, playing devil's advocate, no pun intended, I think he would say they crossed the line, Steve, and are making actual claims.
But the claims are they're not factual claims. They're faith based claims, right? I mean, he's not
a guy named Jesus, born of two people, Mary and Joseph, in Bethlehem, lived in Nazareth.
Yeah, but Perry,
approximate years.
Every myth and every religion has an origin that a lot of people believe are true. A lot of people out there that believe in Adam and Eve too.
Of course.
So,
of course.
You know, there's people that would contest that, but then, you know, there's people that would also say no, they exist. So who's right and who's wrong? You can't really go head to head with faith. I agree with Steve.
I mean, obviously, this guy's trying to undermine the entire basis of religion by saying that you can't make claims that are not proven, you know, factually, otherwise you're guilty of fraud. Now, I think, you know, where people cross the line is when they make, you know, here and now claims of, like, faith healing.
Right.
I think you'd have a case if somebody, you know, got people to throw their medication away on the basis that they were going to heal them. You know, that's almost practicing medicine without a license. But just tenets of faith, you know, that's not going to go anywhere.
It certainly didn't for this guy.
No, not in deeply Catholic Italy, anyway. we got a few emails this week that I'd like to talk about. The first one is from a listener in the Philippines who signs off as Edwardson. He says, "Hello, I just finished listening to your February 8th podcast. Been tuning into your show for about 2 months now. In your latest podcast, you featured an article from the Philippine Daily Inquirer. What can I say? When I found out that the author was none other than Jimmy himself, I couldn't help but snicker." So this is, the guy's name is Lacauco. He's a
whack job, basically.
He's a whack job. He basically, yeah, the emailer writes, he's an old-timer in the woo-woo department in this country. So he basically gives media attention to any, you know, paranormal or pseudoscientific or fantastical notion. So he goes on to write, unfortunately, Lecauco is assuming that non-physical reality exists. But apart from the discredited Targ et al. Examples, he doesn't give us any good substantiation that evinces its reality. Nor does he offer, since he says science won't do, means and methods by which we can reliably investigate and understand non-physical phenomenon. As you mentioned, Lecauco seems to have missed the glaring contradiction in his article at the one hand, claiming that the non-physical is outside the competence of science to investigate, on the other hand, throwing at the reader supposed scientific evidence for it. That's right.
Which we pointed out at the time.
Yeah, we made that point last week. That is so common among purveyors of this nonsense. They always try to have it both ways, saying that what their beliefs are beyond science, but then whenever they can, throwing apparent scientific evidence for their beliefs.
You know, it's nice that since the internet, and hence our podcast, has global reach, we're getting to learn a little more about the noted crackpots in other countries.
That's right.
We know something about the ones here in the U.S., but it's nice to hear about the ones in the Philippines.
It's good to know the Philippines have their crackpots.
How about that special that Randy did, what? It must have been 10 years ago with the that whole...
In Russia, yeah.
In Russia, yeah, behind... Yeah. It was behind the Iron Curtain, or was it after the Iron Curtain?
After it, yeah.
That still freaks me out with those people that were... doing that bit with their hand, you know, waving a hand over the water and all that crap.
The magic water.
Yeah.
That's good. So, yeah, it's good to know that we have, like I said, we have this global reach and that people are giving us feedback from right. these further away places.
Yep. So thanks for writing in and give us some further background. The second email comes from Scott Palmer in Markham, Ontario in Canada. And he writes, I've been downloading your podcasts for a few months now. I enjoyed the recent episode on that discussed HIV denial, and it brought to mind another health issue that I've trying to get some informed opinions on. Like many people, I've been told by my doctor recently that my cholesterol is a bit high. No big surprise, really. It runs in the family. But then I read an article in Discover magazine about a Dr. Norton Hadler. In this article, the doctor made the point that in one large study, lowering cholesterol basically has no effect on reducing the number of cardiovascular deaths. He believes that bypass surgery offers more risks than not having the surgery done at all. He stated that he would be infuriated if any doctor checked his cholesterol without asking and told him if it were up or down. So he basically wants to know, is there any legitimacy to Dr. Hadler's point of view, to his criticism of cholesterol-lowering drugs and bypass surgery and angioplasty? This is a very complicated issue. What I will say is that, you know, Dr. Hadler, his point of view is certainly towards one end of the spectrum. But he does support his position with logic and evidence. He is not, you know, trumping some anti-scientific or some pseudoscientific or supernatural position. He is basically just saying we need to think very carefully before we do a medical intervention on a broad scale and present it to the public as if it is a significant reduction in risk. However, you know, I think that he is making a judgment call about where to set the threshold for benefit. And I think when in his writings, for example, was quoted in that Discover magazine article, you know, he comes off as saying, like, there's no benefit to lowering cholesterol. Well, if you look at all the evidence, there's a very clear benefit to lowering cholesterol in both reducing heart attacks and death. But the reduction in the risk is small, and it's just below what he would consider to be a worthwhile threshold. But I'm not sure that I agree with his threshold. Again, he's definitely towards one end of the spectrum.
But what's he advocating, Steve?
Well, nothing really, just that we do less medicine. I mean, he is very anti-medicalization. He thinks that we should be doing less. That's what I'm saying. He's not saying, and therefore buy my vitamins. You know, he's not doing that. He's just saying we need to be prescribing fewer medications, doing fewer procedures. You know, people need to just live with their headaches and back pain and not, you know, seek medical attention for every ache and pain that they have.
What do you think
about
that?
Because it's costly?
because it's costly, because we're maybe underestimating the side effects and the risks of the things that we're doing.
What's your impression of that?
Steve, let me interject a little.
Go ahead.
I agree partly. I believe that doctors don't pay enough attention to, you know, I think they're more apt to prescribe medication and not push, maybe not quite hard as they should, things like, you know, low-fat diet, exercise, getting fit, that could also take care of a lot of that stuff without, or at the very
least. Honestly, Bob, that is the common mythology, but it's just not true. Physicians, in fact, are at the forefront of advising that patients exercise and, you know, have a good diet. But I can't tell you, of course, that every physician does that, but that is certainly the standard of care.
Mine certainly does.
That is absolutely in the recommendations. You know, primary care doctors spend a lot of their time and attention on risk factor modification, prescribing, you know, nutrition when appropriate, exercise when appropriate, smoking cessation when appropriate, et cetera, et cetera.
But will they try it first? Will they try that first and then, or will they try to do both at the same time?
That's where you get into a little bit of the art of medicine is, you know, what's your threshold for prescribing a cholesterol-lowering drug, for example? Most physicians will try diet and exercise first, and if that doesn't work, the drugs are a backup. There are also a subset of people who have such a strong genetic
predisposition or cause of
hyperlipidemia, of increased cholesterol, that they need drugs. That diet is not going to do it.
I've got a friend who's over 300. It's
right. That's genetic. You're over 300. That's genetic. You need drugs, and I think the evidence clearly supports that. Now, let me throw some numbers at you just to say what we're talking about. If you treat patients with a cholesterol lowering drug, there's different ways of looking at the statistics. For example, how many patients would you need to treat so that after 3 years of treatment, you will have prevented one heart attack? And what's your guys' guess? How many patients do you think you... So how many prescriptions for Lipitor do I have to write over 3 years in order to prevent one heart attack from happening?
1,000.
No, it's 75.
Okay.
Which, it's not that... It's not a lot.
No.
And that correlates to about a 3 or 4% reduction of relative risk and a 1% or 1.2 or 3% reduction in absolute risk. So, in other words, your risk of having a heart attack over the next few years is going to go down from 3% to 2%. That's the effect of the drug.
That doesn't sound very good to me.
Yeah, it's a modest reduction in your risk, and it's very statistical. And we can't predict who that one person is in the 75 whose heart attack we're going to prevent. So, you know, Hadler's point is it's not worth it. It's not worth all of those medications just to prevent that one heart attack. But that's a judgment call. And I don't think he fairly presents it as a judgment call. I think he gets a little dogmatic about that position by saying it doesn't, quote unquote, doesn't work. And I don't think that's a fair assessment. Same thing is true with, it's actually a much more complicated story when you start talking about surgical procedures. Part of the problem is that angioplasty, which is basically using balloons to open up arteries and maybe stenting them open, and now they have sort of drug-treated stents that help them stay open, that you need to compare them to the best non-surgical management, which is lifestyle and maybe, you know, medication, you know, whatever, again, the best sort of judgment is doing everything other than surgery. But they're both moving targets, and by the time a 3 or 4 or 5 year study is completed, the surgical technology is obsolete, and the medication, you know, therapies have changed. So I think where Hadler is correct is in this instance, when we're talking about bypass and angioplasty, is that although if you look at all the evidence, I think there's a reasonable justification for these procedures. They really haven't been demonstrated beyond doubt, and I do think that we need some large medication versus surgery trials to really answer these questions more definitively, and these trials are underway. So I think that eventually these controversies, how do you interpret the evidence, you know, where's the risk and benefit really fall out, when there's a real controversy that can't be resolved by existing evidence, and it's an important question, you know, what tends to happen is, you know, large consensus trials get done. They get reproduced, and then the practice of medicine changes. So I think, you know, 5 years from now, we'll have a lot better evidence on this very question. So I do think this stuff does work itself out over time. But these epidemiological studies take years and years and years to do.
Steve.
Yeah.
Another point, do you think it's correct to focus on just one number, cholesterol? Would it be better to say, instead of lowering your cholesterol by 10 points or 20 points, wouldn't it be better to say, you know, raise your HDL by this amount, lower your LDL by this amount, and wouldn't that be a better effect?
Absolutely. And lowering LDL is the goal, really, not just the total cholesterol, and raising your HDL. And again, that is the standard, to check the HDL and the LDL to, in fact, try to intervene at both. Raise the HDL and lower the LDL.
Can you have too much good cholesterol?
God,
I don't think so.
That number can literally.
That's kind of like having too much money, Perry. You know, it's
yeah.
Is it okay?
Although again, there's so many different sub questions you can ask. Can your LDL be too low?
Right.
You know, can your HDL be too high? You know, is the ratio important or the absolute numbers important? It's if you lower it by drugs, is that as good as lowering it by exercise and diet, et cetera, et cetera. So you can break out so many different questions, and of course, you know, every one is a 10-year trial. You know
what I
mean?
Well, just as a personal anecdote, I was told once that my cholesterols, they were both too low, mm-hmm. But the doctor was concerned that the good one, what is that?
HDL
was way too low, and that was a serious problem.
Yeah, that's more of a problem, in fact, probably than LDL being too high.
Yeah, because the HDL does not just mop up all the nasty stuff, all the nasty fat in your arteries.
To put it simplistically, LDL transports cholesterol to the walls of your blood vessels, and HDL takes it from your blood vessels and brings it back to the liver.
Didn't I say that?
Yeah, it's more. It doesn't mop it up. It's really a transporter. It's a carrier.
That's funny. Steve made it very simple, but it was still more complex than what I said.
Steve, to answer the person who wrote in, to give him a direct answer, sum it up. How would you put it?
Well, I would summarize it. I think that Dr. Hadler is a very important voice in the medical community, in that he's basically raising skepticism about the evidence for a lot of these large-scale interventions, bypass, cholesterol-lowering drugs, and angioplasty. And that is a very, very important discussion and debate for us to have within the medical community. But I do think he is far out to one end, of the spectrum, and I think that he's maybe a little bit too ideological. He's very anti-intervention, anti-medicalization.
Our listeners should just quadruple his exercise and eat a healthier diet, and that'll probably give him more benefit than medication.
Well, I don't know how you derive that from what I said. I'm
trying to help the guy out. He's reaching out, Steve. He wants us to help
him. That's an individualized medical decision that has to be made. Certainly, for most people, unless there are some specific problems that you have, exercise and a good diet are probably the most healthy things, and not smoking. Those three things are the most healthy things you can do for yourself.
Yeah, and he can go out, whack back a few drinks every once in a while, right? You know, go out for a party with the friends. He's good.
Everything in moderation is good. The evidence on alcohol and atherosclerotic disease is still out, but there's some evidence that like a glass of wine a day may actually be protective, may actually help you prevent heart attacks. But that's some soft evidence. There's good evidence that aspirin, drugs that make the platelets a little bit less sticky, basically thin your blood a little bit, reduce the risk of heart attacks and strokes. But that's, again, the same kind of evidence where you have to treat lots of people over years to prevent one heart attack or one stroke. So I would say, yes, exercise and a good diet for everyone, stop smoking for everyone, and then when you need antiplatelet therapy, cholesterol-lowering therapy, that's a specific medical decision you need to make with a competent physician that you feel comfortable with. Well, joining us is Evan Bernstein. Evan, thanks for joining us tonight.
Good evening. Sorry I'm a little late.
That's okay. So now we have a full boat, our usual skeptical rogues. We have a third email, which is also a medical question. This one comes from Michael Orticelli, who is our biggest fan in Arizona.
Hi, Michael.
And one of my best friends, I will add.
thanks for sending us another email. He writes, hey, thanks for the shout-out and love what you guys are doing with the show. Recently, sound clips running overtime, keeping Perry in line, etc. Anyway, I have been running into a lot of people lately doing this colon cleanse thing, and it ranges from a liquid diet all the way out to a diet strictly consisting of lemon juice, maple syrup, and corn fritters, or something like that. Could you please clear up some rumors about the medical truth regarding colon cleansing?
Yes, I can. I think eating just maple syrup and corn fritters is probably unhealthy. Steve?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I couldn't resist the pun that colon cleansing is full of crap. he didn't say the most extreme thing. People actually do, like, coffee enemas or, like, really severe bowel regimens where they completely clean out their bowels. It's not just dietary changes.
You mean enemas are not good for you?
they're not if you're done frequently. No, if you're impacted or you have constipation, sure. But frequently doing enemas to somebody whose bowel function is normal is not a healthy thing.
Why do people think that our body needs help getting rid of toxins?
Because Bob, people tell them it does, and they believe it.
We have a few hundred million years of evolution to help us deal with toxins in the environment, but. Anyway, the whole concept behind colon cleansing is that, we are being assaulted with toxins from everywhere, and these toxins build up in our body, and you can sort of leach them out of the body by cleaning out your colon. And a variant of this is the idea that food gets stuck in our colon, and the food essentially rots there. And as it rots, it leaches, toxins into our body.
It sounds like people are equating it to the drain pipes in their house.
Kind of, yeah.
When there's like buildup of the gunk that, over the years that goes down there, it gets stuck in the pipes.
But, the two causes of disease, according to most, alternative practitioners, are malnutrition and toxins. Those are the two big ones. They always come back to one or the other.
Well, Steve, you just go into any emergency room or a hospital and you'll see loads of people with malnutrition and toxins.
Right.
I mean, God.
Well, it's
silly. I mean, sometimes they grudgingly say, oh, yeah, doctors are good at dealing with trauma. Oh, thanks, for giving us the trauma. But other than that, disease is caused by either toxin or malnutrition. And, those are two causes of disease, but there's also genetic causes and environmental causes and degenerative causes. There's lots of causes of disease. It's not just toxins or malnutrition. So, but those are the ones that they legally can treat, with supplements, etc. And those are sort of these ideas that are very, very appealing. People, basically are arguing that if our bodies were properly nourished and free from external assault by toxins, that we would live 100 years perfectly healthy. That's basically the premise, that our bodies are perfect machines as long as we feed them and we don't kill them with toxins.
Well, you can see the appeal.
That's just not true. Of course you see the appeal is obvious, but, we're not that perfect. I wish we were. I wish that were true. That'd make our job a lot easier.
Well, there is a benefit to it. There's definitely a benefit to eating healthy. And to not being assaulted by chemicals all the time.
Sure, of course. But to trump that into that's the cause of all disease. And the other thing is like with the colon cleansing people is that there's no specific toxins that they can point to. They refer to toxins just abstractly, non-specifically, just toxins. What toxins? They don't know. They have no way of identifying or measuring specific toxins. They don't know what they're talking
and
about.
It's and obvious. The whole idea, it's obvious crap because subluxations cause all disease. We all know that.
Well, now you're getting into the energy medicine, which is sort of the other sort of field of alternative medicine, where disease is caused by blockage or an imbalance of life energy, whether it's the flowing through our nerves and blocked by subluxations, or traditional Chinese medicine uses acupuncture to rebalance the yin and yang of our qi. That's basically all under the conceptual banner of energy medicine, which is pure pseudoscience. I mean, this is now you're going back like 3,000 years.
I don't even want to start talking about toxic energy. That stuff is
toxic energy. Forget
that's
about
awesome. That's bad.
Negative
stuff.
Energy. You got to have your aura fluffed up, and
it's terrible.
Hey, do you guys remember? I think we talked about this a few years back. I remember reading an article where Janet Jackson was getting coffee enemas, and she said that she was flushing out the sad cells. Mm-hmm. You remember that?
I remember that.
No, the sad cells, that, huh?
That was actually the first time I read about people who do this, who go to, mm-hmm. you know, they, it's like going to a beauty salon, but they go to someone that gives them an enema, and they... I wonder what one of those goes for. What does a celebrity pay to get their ass washed out with coffee?
I have no idea.
Good question.
And do they use decaf?
That's a good question. Or can you get a like a mocha latte?
That's
enema?
Right. Can you get flavors?
Steve, I have a great idea. Let's send Michael Orticelli out on a information gathering mission where he has to go get an enema, report back to us, tell us all the pseudoscience they tried to sell him, and we'll report back to our listeners.
If he volunteers, I would never subject anyone to a procedure, you know, at my request.
Knowing him, he'd like it, so.
Well, I'll leave that to you, Jay. You could talk to him.
All right, I'll make it happen.
We'll have a report on a future podcast.
So let's move on to science or fiction. I have another theme-based science or fiction this week in honor of Valentine's Day, which was yesterday. This is a psychology kind of love-themed science or fiction this week. Again, just I should explain how science or fiction works.
Thank
yes,
you.
I should explain the rules. So every week, one of us, usually me, will come up with three science news items or facts. Two are real, two are science, and one is fiction. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to sniff out the fake, and you can play at home. The answers and references will be, of course, on our website on the notes page for this podcast. So, item number one. A recent study refutes the earlier claim of a difference in finger length between heterosexual and homosexual men. Number two. 3-month-old infants prefer faces of people from their own race. And item number three, people in love have chemical changes in the brain that resemble certain types of mental illness. Jay, why don't you get started for us?
I'll start with number three. I think number three is absolutely true. Because I've completely lost my mind and ruined huge segments of my life over women. Anybody that knows me knows this to be true. And I'm going to move on from there. The 3-month-old infants wanting to see people of their own race sounds to me to be complete bull. In my opinion, the children are completely oblivious to things like that. So, you know, I have no opinion on the first one, so I'm going to say number two is fake.
Okay. Evan?
Steve, repeat number one for me, please.
A recent study refutes the earlier claim of a difference in finger length between heterosexual and homosexual men. So basically what that is saying is that previously it was claimed that there is a finger length difference, but a recent study says there is no difference.
And number three again?
Number three is people in love have chemical changes in the brain that resemble certain types of mental illness.
I tell you what, I'm going to agree with Jay on this one, and I'm going to say that number two is the incorrect one.
Okay. Similar reasons?
Similar reasons. Just number one, I'm not at all surprised with. It does sound like it was perhaps a myth to begin with, and they've, you know, come out and corrected that. So that sounds plausible. You know, chemical imbalances or whatever in the brain just seems a lot more plausible. And infants, as far as race goes, you know, I know that infants generally, at least from what I understand, is that they're very good with making out faces, pattern recognition. It's one of the first early development things that they do, but I don't think race specifically has anything to do with it, so that's why I'm going to say number two is, I think, false.
Okay. Perry?
Well, I'll just I'll agree with the other two. It's very PC, so I'm going to go with it for that reason.
All right, Bob?
This is actually a tough one.
all three seem plausible to me. The 3-month-old infants being more attuned. How did you phrase it, Steve? They're more...
Three-month-old infants prefer faces of people from their own race.
You know, that kind of makes sense to me. I noticed they use 3-month-old babies and not... that to me, that seems significant because you would think by 3 months, infants would be very attuned, say, to their mother's face. And anything significantly different from their mother's face, say... someone from another race, I think they wouldn't be as attuned to it as they would be their mother's face. So that makes sense to me. Let's see. Number one sounds very plausible as well. I can't imagine what the correlation would be. And it makes sense that that a study would come out refuting the different finger lengths. And the chemical one, too. I mean, I know Jay, man, and what he went through. And it makes sense that it makes you it makes you a little wacky. You know, and not as maybe not as objective as you would normally be. So I don't know what the hell to say with this one.
Depends on your basic strength of character, Bob. You know, if you're a person of limited character, it could throw you for a loop.
I don't know about that, Perry. I mean, maybe it's my capacity for love that makes me insane, and you're just, you know, as cold as a fish, and everybody knows
could,
it.
Yeah, could be capacity for love. Could be a weak character. Let the audience decide, Bob.
Steve, I'll say...
you're stalling, Bob.
I know.
I'll say
3.
Okay. Well...
Wait, Steve, before you give us the answer.
Yes?
To clarify number one, are you saying that the study showed that homosexual men have longer fingers or shorter fingers?
That makes no difference.
It's... It's the ratio of the second to the fourth finger that's in question.
So it's not like the whole carny bit with small hands and small like cabbage. No.
No.
That only counts for people who have 5 fingers on a hand, by the way.
All right, so we'll start with number 3, Bob. You thought that 3 was the fake one, and everyone else thought that was real. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Number 3 is correct. Is real. Number 3 is science. There have been a number of studies over the last decade or so showing differences in functional MRI scan and in certain, you know, biochemical activity in the brain in people who are actively in, you know, romantically in love versus people who are not. And in fact, their response to the object of their love, the response of their brain to an image of the person they're in love with, is different than to other people, even to like other attractive people.
Yeah.
This recent study, it found that there are patterns in the brain of people who are in love which are very similar to people with obsessive-compulsive disorder.
Yeah, you would say that people with compulsive-obsessive disorder are basically weak characters, wouldn't you?
So, I mean, we all have a little bit of obsessive-compulsiveness, but this some people who have that part of their brain excessively active. And people who are in love show a lot of similar characteristics to people who are obsessive compulsive.
So, Steve, if they have medication for obsessive compulsive disorder, would that work for someone in love?
That's a reasonable hypothesis. It hasn't been tested as far as I know, but it certainly could. I mean, there are medications that we use to treat, you know, either depression or anxiety or whatever, and they always have side effects. Because it's hard to affect just one part of the brain pristinely and not affect any other part of the brain. Because the different parts of the brain use similar signals, the neurotransmitters, and have similar, you know,
receptors. If they happen to be in the same 10% of the brain that's being used.
That's right.
Yeah. Steve, on a super quick sideline, the whole thing about eating chocolate and having it change, or I don't know, there's a chemical in chocolate that makes people feel like they're in...
It activates some of the dopamine reward centers in the same way that being in love does. Yeah, that's actually true. And in fact, the whole being in love bit, you know, both mammals and birds have preferences in choosing a mate. Mammals and birds evolved mechanisms that affect their choice of mates. And what the thinking is that being in love is just a really exaggerated phenomenon of mate choice, that the reward centers become very activated by the presence of, you know, the person that we're in love with. So it's like an attraction system on steroids, basically. So, and it's so extreme that it, you know, again, it actually, you know, both produces behavior and now, you know, biochemical activity. Again, that is similar to, reminiscent of, you know, people who have obsessive compulsive disorder. So that is true. So Bob got that one incorrect. Let's go to number two. 3-month-old infants prefer faces of people from their own race. The other three of you chose that one as being fiction, but that too is science. Bob keyed in on one detail that is helpful in assessing that, and it's 3-month-old infants. In fact, at 1 month, infants display no race preference in their face choice. So we appear not to be born with any preference for one race or another. But by 3 months, infants start to show a preference for race, for the race of what they're used to seeing. It's not just their mother, because if the infant was raised in a multiracial environment, they don't show these preferences. The thinking is that we imprint on people who look like not just our mother or our family, but our tribe, our, you know, the people who are genetically closest to us.
And it takes a tribe.
It takes a village, right. But this may have been an evolutionary mechanism whereby even young children would know to, you know, seek safety among their own tribe and be fearful of another tribe, which could certainly be hostile. So again, that's speculation, but that's you know one possible evolutionary advantage to imprinting, as it were, at an early age on people who look like us, basically. And this is part of a broader sort of research program to try to find the roots of racism and maybe also how to mitigate them. The question then is, do infants who imprint on their own race have different, you know, racial attitudes when they grow up? You know, we don't know that. That's a sort of a question that stems from that research. Number one, this is an interesting one. So there have been a number of studies which show that homosexual males have different ratio of their second finger, which is your index finger, to the fourth finger, which is the ring finger. Now, normally, men have a slightly longer ring finger than index finger, and women have more, those two fingers are more equal in length. And it turns out that that homosexual men have more of a female ratio in their finger length than heterosexual men do. Now, that's was a controversial finding when it first came out. I don't know if you guys remember hearing about that. I remember on the show, The L Word, that sort of brief, I don't know if it's still on. In one scene, you know, they were checking out each other's finger length, you know. So this bit of research made its way into popular culture, at least to that extent. At any rate, there was a recent study published that was a meta-analysis of the five big studies that looked at finger length and sexual orientation, and the meta-analysis confirmed, to whatever extent such studies can, that there was a consistent pattern, and it was consistent between the different studies, and if you look at all the data taken as a whole, the pattern still held up. The thinking is that the finger length differences, the ratio between the second and the fourth finger, is affected by the level of testosterone in the womb at the time the limbs are developing, and that may also develop sexual orientation, you know, and in the developing brain at the same time, that they're linked in the effect that intrauterine levels of testosterone and estrogen have, mainly testosterone actually, during development. So there is a very plausible mechanism for that. It may seem like just a quirky, silly thing, but actually there is a developmental, biological explanation for it.
But Steve, would that remove the genetic component, the possible genetic component for homosexuality?
The thinking is that it's congenital, which just means it's something that is present at birth, but it's not necessarily genetic. It could still be genetic because a gene could determine the level of testosterone. But if testosterone levels were elevated for some other reason, that could also have an effect. even if it's not in the genes of the baby itself.
Okay.
You know what I mean? It could be a maternal effect that's just passed down, even though it's not passed down in the genes. So it's more precise to say that it's congenital, but it may or may not be genetic.
But then wouldn't more siblings in a family be homosexual? Wouldn't you see a correlation between in the family?
If it were a Mendelian genetic trait, then yes.
What does that mean?
Mendelian genetics are like blue and brown eye color. You know, there are specific genes, and you can sort of calculate the odds of getting brown eyes versus blue eyes based upon which versions of those genes that you get. Homosexuality, if it is genetic, and the evidence I think is pretty strong that there is a genetic influence, plus there may be congenital, intrauterine, but not specifically genetic influences. It's certainly not a simple one gene, system. There's no homosexual gene, if you will. It's a more complicated genetic phenomenon.
And this is with men, not this isn't with women.
This data set is with men. I think they also looked at women. I don't recall exactly what the phenomenon was with women, although I think it makes sense that it wouldn't be present because women already have, that ratio. I don't think the women revert to a male ratio. In other words, women who are homosexual. And this recent study was confined to the data on men. So I don't know the answer to that in terms of does a finger length difference hold up with women. But interesting. I mean, it certainly argues, the bottom line is, that this is one piece of evidence that strongly favors that homosexuality is biological. Whatever the cause or causes, it's not, environmental, it's not a choice, it's,
The Reverend Falwell is not going to be happy with
it. It's biologically predetermined. You're born with your sexual orientation, which makes sense. And not only homosexuals, but also heterosexuals, from a very young age, we had gender identification, and the, homosexuals knew their gender, their sexual orientation from a very young age, as long as they could remember. It was just the way they were. It wasn't a lifestyle choice they made later on in life, you know what I mean?
It's interesting.
Yeah, it always annoys me when people assume that it's a conscious choice and they could just, flip their switch and be normal. It's like, come on.
It's just childish. It's childish.
You three fathers, would it affect you if any of your daughters came to you and said that they were gay?
I might prefer it.
God. Yeah, right.
Oh my God. I mean, would it cause you to think any differently about your kids in any way?
Not in the slightest.
Not at all.
Yeah,
not
I mean,
flinch.
It certainly would not affect how much I love my daughters. I mean,
God.
That's overwhelming.
And, so no impact. Absolutely.
It's
invisible.
Hard, how can you say until it happens, right?
Well, because you know yourself.
I don't think, certainly intellectually, I have no problem with it, and I can't imagine that it would affect how much I love my daughters. It might bring up concerns of family dynamics, et cetera, that we would have to deal with. Who knows? I mean, it's so far beyond my experience at this point, it's hard to speculate as to what would happen. But
how about you, Perry?
I don't have any kids.
I don't either, but, I mean,
I could speculate all the way from someone without kids.
Go ahead.
If you'd like me to.
Yeah, I'll tell you what I think, too.
Would have absolutely no impact on how I felt about my kids. And the only way I can arrive at that being childless is because whether or not a person is gay or straight in my regular life has no impact on what I think about the person.
I think if it were my children, I probably would be uncomfortable and unhappy about it in the beginning, and then as I got used to it, I would probably be upset in the beginning just because, I think it would make their life harder, and it would, it's an obstacle for them to deal with. But I don't know. I don't think I'd ever not love my child for anything like that.
I think parents might fall into a trap that they trap themselves in that they feel it's some kind of failing on their part that their child perhaps turned out that way. Whereas that's, not really the way people should be looking at that.
The facts don't support that position. This is one situation where, science would liberate you from ideas which could be very malicious, in your personal life.
Right.
Now, if my kids were going to Star Trek conventions too much, then I'm really upset. That will have an effect.
How do you define too much?
I don't know. I mean, you got to go to one just to check it out. The Freak Show is great.
Excuse me.
You know, they're going to one a month. They're dressing up like Spock. You know, then we got problems.
Different set of issues, I'll admit. Different
yeah, that's a whole other topic.
Let's do. We're almost out of time, but we have time for I think one more quick issue. In the UFO end of the pseudoscience spectrum, there's an article. I think Perry, you sent me this one.
I did.
The Steve, Marshall blamed for UFO cover up.
Yeah, basically, I tried to do a little more research on this topic from when I picked out that article. Basically, what all this stems from is. Way back in February 25th of 1942, so this is not a short time after December 7th, 41, Pearl Harbor, there was
pre-Roswell.
There was a an air raid over Los Angeles on the West Coast, and about 2:30 in the morning, a blackout was called. At about 3:15, it's claimed that a wave of planes came over, anti-aircraft guns opened fired, and then around 4:16, the same thing happened, a sort of a second wave. And again, guns blazed and opened fire. According, I guess to official reports, they couldn't identify the aircraft, and no aircraft were brought down.
Right. It was mass hysteria brought on by jittery wartime nerves.
Exactly. And the West Coast was very jittery at that time.
Oh, sure.
All right. But then they claim, this is the ufologist basically, they claim that General George C. Marshall, he of the Marshall Plan, a very famed
Secretary of Defense,
Nobel Peace Prize, on and on. They claim that he wrote a memo to the White House, and he claims that he says they claim that he says regarding the air raid over Los Angeles, it was learned by Army G2. This is a quote from him allegedly that Rear Admiral Anderson recovered an unidentified airplane off the coast of California. With no bearing on conventional explanation, this headquarters has come to the determination that the mystery airplanes are in fact not earthly, and according to secret intelligence sources, they are in all probability of interplanetary origin, unquote. And then it says he went on to sort of cause the Army G2 to create a unit called the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit. To investigate these things.
The IPU.
The IPU. That's right. The IPU. there's a fella named Bland who works at the George C. Marshall Library who has discussed this in the past, and he says, he thinks it's all nonsense.
Right.
He thinks that the thing was forged. He said, in fact, it'd be easy to do with a pair of scissors and a copying machine, to put the general signature on the bottom of any memo you want, and so forth. The only thing I found somewhat interesting about this whole play here is that there was a fella who tried to get some information in 1984 under the Freedom of Information Act. He just sort of wrote to the Army, and he said, look, I want any information you have on the IPU, okay? And he was written back by a Lieutenant Colonel Lance R. Cornine. And the guy says in his letter, it's not too long, he says basically that, in your response, in your request, regarding your request about the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, it was disestablished, and as far as we are aware, he says, all records, if any, were transferred to the Air Force in the late 50s. The unit, quote, was formed as an in-house project purely as an interest item from the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence. It was never an actual unit, he says. It had no investigative function. It was not formally organized. It had no mission or authority. It was not reportable. And he said, it's only through institutional memory that any recollection exists of the unit at all. And then he just goes on to say, we're therefore unable to meet your request. There's nothing to give you. There's nothing here. is basically what the guy said. And that's about it. That's, you know, yeah. People point to this and they say, look, even the renowned George C. Marshall was part of a UFO cover-up because of this.
Yeah, it's nonsense. I mean, this is very reminiscent of the MJ-12 documents, the so-called Majestic 12 documents, which were, again, allegedly signed by Harry Truman, although the signature was found to have been a copy of a signature on record, which probably will be the same case with the Marshall document. And these documents come out of nowhere. You know, like they have no history. Someone just sort of has them and produces them. They cannot be authenticated in any way. So, I mean, they're obvious frauds. These are just fraudulent documents, and they don't prove a thing. And it's just consistent with the narrative of the UFO mythology, but don't represent evidence in and of themselves in any way. So this is a replay, it sounds like, of the MJ-12 documents. And the reading that I did on this specific thing, the ufologists themselves made that link, that it was probably, you know, Majestic 12 that was in charge of this whole thing, you know.
Right.
This is just a part of the same, you know, government conspiracy cover-up phenomenon.
And this guy in charge of Marshall's documents at his library says it's, you know, he thinks it's nonsense. So, you know, he's very, very familiar with the general's writings and feelings, and you know, it's so easy to fraud in this to make mm-hmm. fraudulent mm-hmm. this day and age. It's nonsense.
And still, you know, they always have to justify. Well, why would there be a 60-year, you know, government cover-up, 60, 70-year government cover-up of UFOs? And they have the same lame excuses. Oh, because the government knows that, you know, that there would be public panic, you know, if they ever acknowledged that you know, flying saucers had crashed on the Earth. There would? Public panic? That's total nonsense.
It's nonsense. It is ridiculous.
Well, if these UFOs came out of the clouds, like, what's that movie, Independence Day or whatever.
That would panic.
That's panic.
Different. That's different.
That's different than saying 60 years ago, by the way, we found a crashed saucer.
Yeah, that's different than a busted up crashed, you know.
Right.
Look at these fierce guys.
I would panic if a ship like Independence Day slowly came through the clouds, bigger than the city, just hovering up there. I would panic because they'd be breaking the laws of physics.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. Well, Carl Sagan wrote, you know, Carl Sagan wrote that, you know, if and when we get visited by aliens, we're going to know about it, no doubt about
right.
it. There will be no secret element.
That's
to
right.
It. The world will absolutely know.
Worldwide news event. Absolutely no way to hide that. I mean, our government can't hide a BJ in the Oval Office.
That's right.
It can't hide anything. Of any significance for any amount of time. You know, you can't even get through a single administration keeping these secrets under tab.
It's true.
There's no... How can you possibly keep a worldwide conspiracy over generations and multiple different administrations this secret? And this is where conspiracy theories become absurd, because they have to just keep expanding the conspiracy to answer the concern. Well, it's a worldwide conspiracy involving thousands of people with unbelievable power and manipulative... Oh, whatever.
Talk about widening the gaps.
Ridiculous.
They're chasms.
They say that the whatever was shot down that night in 42 is in Hangar 18.
Right.
Is that in Area 51 or is that a different hangar?
Hangar 18.
It's about 38 hangars, 35 hangars down the road.
Oh my God.
Yeah, Hangar 18 is in Area 51. That's right.
It is. Okay. So yeah. It's in there. Well, that's where it is. It's
along hangars. With the other UFOs.
I don't want to burst your bubble, but Hangar 18 is a strip club now.
Yeah. People have been losing interest in aliens in recent
I hear
years.
It's a bar for people with you know, second and fourth fingers that, you know, don't quite match up.
Steve, could I bring up one more Valentine's Day related issue or topic?
Absolutely.
This will be very brief. I used 1-800-Flowers and the service was so bad. First off, my girl didn't even get her flowers at all. Did not receive her flowers. I could not call up their support line because it was too busy. So I'm just
that's your story, and you're
sticking with
it.
That's a good story.
It's the truth.
Same thing, Steve.
She's got to listen to this and know it's the truth. No, the bottom line is I just want to tell everyone, don't even waste your time with that horrible company. They suck.
I actually used 1-800-Flowers about a month and a half ago send my wife some flowers down in New Orleans, and they were able to deliver on time in a hurricane-ravaged area the flowers I'd ordered.
Well, there we go.
Pleasant experience with them.
Competing anecdotes.
<Yeah. laughs>
Very good.
Just telling you like it is.
Well, Steve, it's not an anecdote. It's my story.
We'll find a way to use that.
All right, we're out of time, guys. Thanks again for joining me.
Good night, everybody.
Evan, Perry, Bob, Jay.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
See you next round.
Until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is a production of the New England Skeptical Society. For information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.thenes.com. You can send us questions, comments, and suggestions to podcast@thenes.com. Theorem is performed by Kinetto and is used with permission.